Crockett University librarian, and I want to welcome you to the opening event of the Human Sexuality Collection's 25th anniversary. I think you're going to like the rest of my introduction as well. In an era of sexual repression. Fewer of you than I thought, but some of you were there. It was a time when women had curfews, and the 3 feet on the floor rule applied to visiting the dorm rooms of members of the opposite sex. In 1960, the year the pill was approved for contraceptive use, Cornell conducted what I think was their very first survey of sexual attitudes and behavior among undergraduates. This will probably surprise you, but the entire sample of women surveyed reported that they were virgins. Noting that the Gannett Health Center had no official policy toward the dispensation of birth control information and devices, the student government proposed a series of lectures and films on the topic, and also made note of the fact that students at the University of Michigan could, quote, volunteer to act as test cases for various birth control devices. Fast forward another 25 years, and while the sexual revolution was mainstream, the AIDS epidemic spread quickly, infecting 1 million Americans by 1985 and shaping a whole generation's attitude about sex. Back then, there were few places in the academy who were documenting sexuality in any kind of comprehensive way. There was the Kinsey Institute, a library at Indiana University, which focused on biology and clinical studies. And there was the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe, which collected material on women's health and sexuality. But here, in upstate New York, our library was making big plans. These were heady days, thinking about our brand new endeavor, its scope, and the parameters. We wanted to define sexuality in the very broadest of terms and figure out how we could make this collection truly useful not only for research, but also for educational purposes. It felt risky, right at the edge of what conservative, traditional academics considered scholarship at the time. And there was resistance from the other side, too. Many lesbians and gay men didn't trust the establishment and its formal institutions. They were excluded by libraries and universities in the past, so they'd taken charge by creating their own organizations, run by community volunteers such as the Lesbian Her Story Archives in New York City. Crossing over that threshold and coming into the academy was a very big deal. Cornell took up the challenge with great enthusiasm. The faculty were absolutely key in supporting the founding of the Human Sexuality Collection, and they played a decisive role in defining and defending the broad range of materials that would be included. I was honored to serve on the search committee that brought Brenda Marston to Cornell. We'd met through the Society of American Archivists and had served on a panel together on documenting lesbian and gay history. She'd always impressed me, so it was great to see her application in the pool. For her part, Brenda remembers sitting in a park in Madison, Wisconsin, and opening the SAA newsletter, Society of American Archivists newsletter, to a job announcement for this position. She was finishing her master's degree at the time, and she said it felt like being hit by a bolt of lightning. The luckiest lightning is the image she describes. Perhaps it's no surprise she included an image in the exhibition that shows a love-struck Parisian woman felled by a bolt of lightning, and you'll have to go see it for yourself. For the past 25 years, Brenda has made the Human Sexuality Collection her life's work, and we couldn't imagine a better curator for that collection. She's so dedicated and so passionate about this field, yet she is a gentle steward of the material she collects. she thinks that of herself more as a midwife than as a curator. Instead of dictating the collection's direction, she guides it and cares for it, and then releases it to researchers who will use it to create new knowledge and scholarship, and also enhance the knowledge and use of it by students. Brenda also takes the human sexuality collection to students herself. 2 years ago, when she was teaching in one of Dagmawi's Wobsha's classes, she was showing posters and other materials from AIDS activists. One of the students asked why everyone looked so angry. This student couldn't understand what people were so upset about, because in her lifetime, everyone got AIDS education in school and knew there were effective treatments to manage its effects. She wasn't alive in the 1980s when AIDS was devastating gay communities. It was a mystery disease that people wanted to ignore, and our president, Ronald Reagan, refused to even say the word AIDS. Primary sources, such as those assembled in this collection, bring this history to those whose filters have been shaped by the present. Andrew Dixon White, Cornell's first president, understood the value of collecting primary source materials from his own time. Things like photographs and scrapbooks and pamphlets from the Civil War, abolition, and more. These subjects weren't deemed worthy of classical education, but he knew these primary sources were vital to a Cornell education and critical to understanding history. The library continues this legacy, working on the edge and archiving unconventional modern-day collections. We do it not only in human sexuality, but also with our hip-hop and punk collections, and by adding modern items to more traditional collections, such as the witchcraft collection we've just recently been ordered, including more movie posters dealing with vampires and the like. If some skeptics don't see the value in pulp novels about lesbian space aliens and spray paint cans that kids in the Bronx used to do graffiti on subways, well, we believe that will join the skeptics who questioned Andy White's collecting choices but later claimed them as their own. Without concerted effort, our view of the past will keep settling on a familiar, comfortable scene. As curator of the Human Sexuality Collection, Brenda keeps resting the camera away from the center to capture pictures of sexuality that aren't normally on our TV screens or billboards. Even in a field like this, it is easy and tempting to start collecting happy, pretty stories. But she's made sure that we continue to not ignore the stories of queer people living in poverty and to turn the focus on the diversity of our culture. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce our panelists for tonight. We're so excited, Susie, that you are back to Cornell. Susie Bright is the country's preeminent feminist sex writer, and she's written 6 best-selling books. She last visited us about a year ago to give us the Sexual State of the Union talk when she donated her own personal archives to the library. Susie is a founding editor of On Our Backs, the groundbreaking 1990s lesbian sex magazine, and she's a renowned author, editor, and podcaster. Susie is a wonderful friend to our library, and we're so glad she's returned to celebrate this anniversary with us. We're also pleased to welcome Urvashi Vaid to Cornell. Her leadership in the LGBT movement spans more than 30 years. She served as the staff attorney for ACLU's National Prison Project and the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. She was the executive director there when the task force decided to place their records here at Cornell, and I'd like to thank you for your pivotal role in that. Currently, she is the director of the Engaging Tradition Project at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. She's written extensively on lesbian and gay politics, class and equality, and she's working on a new book about how sexual and gender justice movements can engage tradition-based resistance. I first came to know her work through her thoughtful op-ed pieces in Out Magazine nearly 20 years ago, and I'm delighted to welcome you here to Cornell. Director and producer David France is an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author who has been writing about AIDS since 1982, beginning in gay community papers. Today, he is one of the best-known chroniclers of the epidemic, writing in the New York Times, Newsweek, and New York Magazine, where he is now a contributing editor. He is currently at work on a major history of AIDS, which will be published in 2015, just in time for Cornell's sesquicentennial. As a documentary filmmaker, he directed the Oscar-nominated How to Survive a Plague, and he did some of the research for that film with materials from our very own collections here at Cornell. And Bag Wobsheth will be moderating tonight's panel. He is an associate professor of English here at Cornell, and he's the author of a forthcoming book, The Calendar of Loss, Race, Sexuality, and Mourning in the Early Era of AIDS, and co-editor of Ethiopia, Literature, Art, and Culture, a special issue of Kalalu. In 2010, he was named a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum, and his other honors include a faculty fellowship at the Institute of Ethiopian Studies at Addis Ababa University in 2010 and 11, and the Robert A. and Donna B. Paul Award for Excellence in Advising in 2012. Last fall, he was named one of the 10 best professors at Cornell by Business Insider. A peripatetic scholar, he divides his time among Ithaca, New York City, and Addis Ababa. Please join me in welcoming our wonderful panel.
Thank you, Ann, for that great introduction. I've been told to speak very closely into the mic, and if I get distracted by the thing that's a phallic thing jutting out, just bring me back to the conversation. I'm really thrilled to moderate this discussion with these extraordinary people. And before we start, I thought I want the audience help. Help me set the tone of the conversation. Collectively, we're going to thank Brenda Martson and her colleagues at the Human Sexuality Collection for organizing such a fantastic exhibition and the set of events around the show, like this one. So instead of just clapping, we're going to shout or moan, groan, scream, let out whatever pleasure, sound, or silence that leaps to mind. That's how we're going to pay our gratitude, okay? So now on 3, 2, come with it. 1.
Excellent, excellent.
All right, so I want to begin by asking you all a very simple question. That is, why is it important to have an exhibition that foregrounds the subject of sex and sexual dissidence?
You know, I often wonder why every exhibit doesn't have sex at the foreground. The only reason it doesn't is because of the shame and secrecy and control over sexuality. How many of us have had perhaps someone in your family or someone you cared about, and after they had passed, everyone said, well, we wanted to know more about them, but everything was destroyed, you know, and you start to wonder about these mystery characters. And if you've ever had that in your own family, well, just imagine human history at large. So often, an explanation for why something happened the way it did was because of a sexual path and sexual decisions. It's just like breathing. Why is it ever excluded? I suppose, you know, sometimes people say, well, if you did a good job, Susie, you'd put yourself out of business. And, you know, I agree, that I would applaud it. And if we had a much more enlightened view of integrated history, perhaps, you know, we would look at this archive with different eyes, too.
I think that I agree with you, and I think the control of sex, the conversation about it, the performance of it, the consequences of it, or the imagined consequences of talking and doing it, the control of all of that is such a source. I mean, it is the source of repression for women, for men, for gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people, for all people. And I think the kind of control and relegation of sex to a private, shame-ridden, secret, we don't talk about it sphere was one of the things that the feminist movement tried to undo, you know, by bringing things out into the open. It's one of the things that the LGBT movement, when it was called the Gay Liberation Movement, tried to do before it became the marriage movement, tried to do, right? I mean, we went from sexual outlaws to the married couple next door. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting progression. Mm-hmm. But I think that sex is so important to each of us. That's why I think it's important to talk about sex and to have shows about it. We talk about it with each other. I think, at least I do. And with my friends and, you know, buddies, and we obsess about it, we worry about it, we think about our performance, we rank it, we talk about other people's sex lives, but it's still like a dirty little secret.
It still is, you're right. And you know what this exhibit made me realize is that, and think about, was how powerful movements are. And you see in the course of this exhibit, the years covered in the exhibit, how the impact of activism, the impact of social justice movements made a huge difference over time. In the few years that are covered in the exhibit, 100 and some odd years, you can see, it's really is, as you were saying, Susan, the history of, you know, of it's human history expressed through this little window. And such a powerful window. And you see in each one of those advances the role of individuals in claiming the unclaimable, naming the unnameable, and making it part of something fresh, something accessible, something affirming. When I started college, in the college library, I looked up homosexuality in the card catalog, and it didn't exist. It referred me instead to sexuality, deviance. Hmm. And that's where the conversation was then, you know, those few years ago. And that, and I can see it in this joyous way through this exhibit and through this conversation that's being kind of brought together over such a small period of human history, how people have made that difference, and how making that difference impacts that idea of identity and affirmation. And for that reason, I think it's a tremendously powerful and essential to have sex in the institution.
Well, if I could follow up that question and ask, is I think about contemporary American culture, I can't help but notice contradictory way, even a hypocritical way, of representing sex. It seems it's everywhere and nowhere at once. We find it readily in our movies, TV shows, music videos, political scandals. At the same time, rarely do we find an honest, vulnerable discussion of sex on the public stage. And I wonder if you see that, or how you might explain these competing attitudes, if you will, of exposure and cover-up of sex at the same time.
You know, I mean, I think that the mainstream culture reflects the kind of contradictory way people still feel about sex. The idea of sex as a positive thing is still rejected by many religious institutions, by many societies, including this one. Mm. I'm losing my train of thought. I have so many things I want to say about it. But I think that, like, I was trying to think of an example of how sexual freedom is not really talked about in the public sphere. And I think the best example I can give is the LGBT movement and its own discussions about sexuality and how muted they have become. Mm-hmm. When I came up in the 70s, I was in college in the 70s, the conversation, we talked about how sex was depicted in the public eye. Mm-hmm. We protested it. We went to protests and pickets about the movie, about movies like Windows and Cruising. We talked about the denigration of women. We talked about, but we also talked about the affirmation of sexuality and of pleasure as a positive thing. Mm-hmm. When I think about the argument in courts today in the marriage cases, we're still arguing about sex. Sex is, you know, for procreation. Mm-hmm. They're still arguing that the only legitimate role for marriage is to have procreative sex. Mm-hmm. I mean, we haven't really come that far in 30 or 40 years. Mm-hmm. If major institutions, if serious people are standing up in courtrooms across this country and saying that marriage is for procreation and the containment of sex.
Well, that's one of the things that this exhibit shows so well, is how public policy and the law is like the last shoe to drop. If you can look back a century and more and see examples of sexuality used to titillate, to sell something, to encourage someone. Even if it's silly, even if you laugh at the commodification and say, oh, you know, they want you to buy this because then you will be desirable. But after you buy that, you're going to have to buy one more thing. And there's so many pieces in the exhibit that show the history of the advice manual, how to, you know, I want to have sex, or even how you must stop masturbating. I mean, that book, it's this thick, and about like 7-point type about why you must stop masturbating. But, you know, lots of advice that is supposed to lead to happiness, either because you abstained or because you finally figured out a trick or two. There's that. There's the titillating material, you know, whether it's movie posters or those naughty postcards. I mean, you have that. And then you have the protest and civil rights examples, all of which I think that our movement, you know, women's lib and gay lib, at that, all that 60s and 70s counterculture, was when notions of creating a sexuality that showed vulnerability and intimacy and wasn't about selling you anything in particular except an encouragement to be honest and to be authentic. I think some of my favorite parts of the collection are pieces from Honey Lee Cottrell. I'm going to make you guys raise your hands. Just raise your hand, Honey Lee. You'll see a lot of her work. She was the first staff photographer of the first women's erotic magazine about anything ever on our backs. Our first art director, Lulu Bellevo. Lulu, you have to raise your hand. When you walk into the exhibit, you'll see these fantastic, one woman who's wrapped in caution tape and a bunch of other women who are all in a circle kissing, photo taken by Jessica, who is here. She is just arrived. We've all come in from a million places. You missed us earlier today, but we pinned Lulu down and said you were there when these photos were taken, and we're setting up the models and the art direction. What was that all about? So there's... to look back on that, people say, why did you do it? And it was such a temper tantrum at the time. You know, like I was so tired of people thinking that we were sexless, just blank cards with some kind of political agenda that didn't have anything to do with sexuality and humanity, it was great to turn that upside down.
I was thinking as you were talking about the that there must be something to say about the cyclical nature of the way we talk about sex and mm-hmm. how we have these moments, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s, the 20s, the 40s around the war, the 60s and 70s, and there's got to be somebody who can say something smart about that. I can't, unfortunately. But what I realized as I was thinking about that was that we've been in decline, I think, in our discussion about sexuality since AIDS. And we've never really reclaimed that. We've never recovered from that. And sex took a really, took a near-fatal blow in the early 80s. And it was held responsible for so much. And it was blamed. And the people engaged in it were blamed. And the discussion of it was blamed. And so really so much about the way outlaws became in-laws, as you were saying, is sad, but it comes from there. It comes from that idea that we've taken to heart too much, I think, this idea that sex has terrible consequences, and so if you look at those cycles, every 20 years or so, we're well beyond that now, and it's, you know, and there's no movement to bring that back that
until
I've seen anyway.
Until tonight.
Until now. So yeah. Doors closed. We're going to do this.
But you know, David, it's interesting when you talk about that, because in some ways, though, the AIDS epidemic in the 80s, you know, brought forth a conversation about sex that hadn't happened in, like, news media, for sure. Because I'll never forget sitting somewhere and seeing, you know, Ted Koppel or somebody talking about anal sex on ABC News and transmission and being very explicit and there being, you know, graphics and stuff behind him. And they had to start talking about, or we pushed it, the movement pushed the media to start talking about transmission and the mechanics of it and, you know, because it was like about saving lives. You had to get the information out. And there was a big fight for Surgeon General Koop to even release a semi-explicit pamphlet about AIDS in the early 80s, and 84, 85, I think it came out, or 86, the Surgeon General's, you know, first thing on AIDS. It was 5 years after the epidemic had been raging in the gay community.
And what that did was re-medicalize the conversation about sex and homosexuality.
It did.
And you can't have erotic and medical. You know, that really doesn't work. Although there's probably a website that I don't know about.
There's probably a kink about erotic and medical.
And there have been some efforts culturally to claim sex. Because gay men were taking, you know, were involved in such traumatic battles for survival in the 80s. Women, the lesbians especially, kind of took up the cudgel of sexuality and you know, for a period of time. And but it just, as far as kind of driving culture the way say the 60s and 70s drove culture, we haven't gotten anywhere near that.
Well, I thought I'd follow that up maybe by asking you all individual questions. Susie, when I think about your work, the phrase that comes to mind along with sex radical and sex positive is self-ownership. And I think about the variety of forums, as you just mentioned, On Our Backs, the first women's sex magazine, starting the Best American Erotica series, your weekly program to which I subscribe, and I think you all should, In Bed with Susie Bright. I have picked up a lot of tips. I have made many a man happy. Well, you, all this to say that you have opened up such a necessary space and have engendered a vocabulary for us, for, you know, us to take our sexual identities seriously, the fact that we're sexual beings. So I wonder if you could just comment on this imperative, a kind of abiding principle in your work that we broach publicly our deepest and most private fantasies and fetishes.
Well, some people have said to me, well, if it was up to you, Susie, do you just want everyone to march around in the nude, you know, just babbling incoherently about things we'd rather not, you know, be inundated with? You know, is that your idea of a utopia? Because I'm getting earplugs. You know, like, enough is enough. And I, there is no danger of privacy and ambivalence and daydream and imagination, and, you know, none of that is going to leave the human mind and heart ever. You know, as much as I learn about myself and have compassion and insight into other people's sexuality, as much as I understand that sex doesn't lie, and if you can figure out people's sexual motives, it's very much like follow the money. I mean, every time I, you know, am bedeviled by something that's happening in the world, I follow the money and I follow the sex, and it always takes me to the, you know, the end of the line. There's always, it's that onion, and you keep going. When I was looking at the archives as I began sending my boxes to Cornell and packing things, and phew, you know, just took a lot out seeing who was gone. You know, it was like a memorial. It was grieving. It felt so good to know that they were going to some place where the public could really look through this, because I'd been here before. And when Brenda took me into what she nicknames the vault, you know, with all the existing rare manuscripts and collections, I just wanted them to lock me in and put little bread and water through a slot. You know, like, yes, this is where, if we don't have this kind of documentation, no one really knows what happens, because you have to have multiple people talking about the same events and the same images to find out what really happened, because my memory and your memory of that night, you know, is going to be different. And you need, no one can really tell history well if we don't have verification and comparisons. This time looking at it, I thought about secrets I had back then that I didn't talk about. You know, everyone thought we were so brazen hussies, you know, doing this magazine, or that I was some kind of nut going to review porn films and theaters all by myself with a little notebook. But now I look back and I look at those pictures of those women and what we said, and we had other secrets. We were very diverse in our backgrounds. You saw some of it, you could see by the color of the people in the magazine. Other times it was because so many of us were working class, or we were working as whores or sex workers to fund our first college education or to be the first person in the family. Those on our backs wouldn't have been funded if it wasn't for, I mean, our first issue was so expensive. This is before digital anything. If it hadn't been for the receipts of prostitution and stripping, the first issue would not have come out. But we thought everyone was so against us. The last thing we could do was just add another thing for them to have to digest. And so better to just kind of, after all, it was illegal, not talk so much about that. And yet, historically, it's huge. I mean, when I look at the sex workers movement today internationally, and people looking for civil rights, and so many men and women saying, well, this is my work, it's a labor issue, my private life, I happen to be gay, or I happen to be bi. That was the very beginning of those discussions. But even then, it was something we kept to ourselves.
Urvashi, you know, you've been at the very forefront, vanguard of LGBT progressive politics, and I can't think of a better person to reflect on the inextricable link between sex and politics. You know, with the work you've done with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, ACLU, your books, Virtual Equality and Irresistible Revolution. I've always sensed your work issuing, for us to take our sexual difference and dissidence, not just to transform this sexual laws and mores, but actually to transform the very basis of society. And you were mentioning earlier the kind of mainstreaming of gay politics has, if you will, domesticated the transgressive force of queer life. So I wonder if you could say something about how that how your work over the decades has been at that intersection of sex and politics.
Sure. I mean, you know, sex and politics was the kind of the conversation, the doing of, the practice of sex and politics was how I got excited about politics and about everything. It was, to me, the conversation was wrapped up with feminism. And what I want to reflect on for a minute is how, in the course of 35 years in the LGBT movement, in many ways, I feel like we've moved away from that focus on the politics of gender, sexuality, and maleness and femaleness. And it's expressed today most in the trans movement and in trans politics. Absolutely, it's there. But in the mainstream LGBT movement or even in the feminist movement, I feel like it's much different than how I experienced it. So to me, sex is the core of a motivation for all of us. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the primary things of you got to eat, you got to have shelter. Sex is like right in there. But it's never been regarded as that. Okay. Certainly the classical leftists never regarded it as a central issue, sex or gender, you know? To me, it's like one of those driving human needs and motivations. And when you look at the apparatuses of social control, mm-hmm. whether it's the courts and laws, whether it's religious institutions, whether it's the family, the repression and control of sexual behavior is a central part of all of those disciplinary regimes. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them that you can think of. And so that makes me think about sex, and not just sex, unethical sex, you know, bad, like there's good sex and bad sex, and it isn't about performance, it's about ethics. Hmm. And like so violent, coercive sex, coerced sex versus consensual sex. Those are the conversations that I sort of remember having at Gay Community News. When I was an impressionable 22-year-old, had graduated from college, and I went to Boston to join the women's movement. That's what I did. And I worked as I got a job as a legal secretary for a couple of lawyers. Like, I sat there and typed, and they looked at me and said, "What are you doing here with a degree from Vassar College? Why are you a legal secretary?" I said, I said, "Honestly, I need a job that pays the rent so that I can work my other job, which was in like feminist organizations and queer activism." That's what I was doing at night and on the weekends. And in those days, you never ever thought that you'd get a J-O-B in that work. I mean, there were like two people who got paid to do that work in the whole country. And you weren't going to be one of them. You know, you could just be sure of that, right? So we made up our own careers. And I didn't, I was a secretary.
And I didn't know that because I was about your age, I forget how many years are between us, out in the West Coast, reading these people in Boston, reading you for the first time, and also not knowing how to say your name, but saying, she's incredible.
Well, I feel like I came into a kind of a milieu of incredible artists, writers, thinkers, doers, people like me who were thinking about sex and politics and the intersection of that. And Gay Community News was this weekly newspaper actually produced by a collective, believe it or not. And, you know, to which David was a writer, you contributed, you know, people all over the country.
when men and women did sexual politics together.
Yeah, we worked together and we argued about everything. Like why is this cover of a male penis on the picture? You know, there was this barbed wire penis cover that this artist created to dramatize sodomy laws. And it was wonderful. It was a gorgeous graphic. But boy, did the lesbian feminist separatists get pissed about that. Okay? And then there was this, the next 2 weeks later, there was a cover by Jennifer Camper, this incredible lesbian comic, cartoonist, of a woman with her breasts shown on a motorcycle, you know, saying something about her tits. And that got all the gay men, I don't want to see tits in my paper. You know? It was like, we actually had conversations about the ick factor that we had about each other's genitals, about each other's sexual pleasures. And to me, those were formative conversations in which, you know, we sort of talked about things with each other and we were building a movement and building institutions at the same time that we were having these conversations. And so they were infused with this thinking about sex. And I took that, you know, I went from that right into AIDS activism because AIDS hit all of my people and we had to do something, so we did. And I do agree with you, David, that very exciting conversation really did shift into a different direction. So I don't know if I answered your question, Dag, but I just went with that memory.
Well, David, coming to you, I'm struck by a thread that I see in your work as, you know, a highly acclaimed journalist and author and filmmaker, and that is the relationship between sex and crisis, right? So your book, Our Fathers, provides a powerful chronicle of the Catholic Church sexual abuse crisis. You helped to write The Confession, Governor James McGreevy's memoir, ex-governor from New Jersey who came out and resigned amid public controversy, and most recently, How to Survive a Plague, a remarkable documentation of the early era of AIDS and AIDS activism. I know these are different types of crises. I don't want to conflate them, but I wonder if you could say something about how, in each case, our inability to talk about sex then compounds itself into a crisis.
You are absolutely right. That's the area that I'm really fascinated in, where sex gets us in trouble, and why. And there's the medical aspect of it, and there's the cultural aspect of it. But I'll speak to two of the projects that you mentioned, Our Fathers and The Confession. Both, and this in part picks up on what Irvashi was just saying about how, 30 some odd years ago, we didn't think that there would ever be a kind of a culture that would allow gay people to have, you know, any real place in it. It seemed impossible, although we set about trying to do it anyway, so we had a kind of a hubris about it, and it actually kind of worked. And what interested me about the Catholic Church sexual abuse crisis that blew up in 2001 was the data, the irrefutable data that nobody was talking about, which was that the criminals, the people who were engaging in these criminal and offensive behaviors were gay men. And nobody wanted to say it. I was working at Newsweek at the time, and they wouldn't let me say it at Newsweek. All these like straight people saying, you know, no, we can't do that, we can't say that because it's too dangerous. Well, it was true. It was absolutely true. And and to look at that truth taught us things. And that's what Our Father's undertaking was, to try to find out who these people were. And what I discovered is that like so many gay men in the 70s, after Stonewall, crawled out of cultures that were killing them and got to places like San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles and you know, got to the margins of the country in a way to save their own lives. And we never really looked back at the people who couldn't get out, who were still there, who either weren't smart enough to get out or weren't brave enough to get out or had they just or couldn't afford in one way or another. And what happened to them? Who did we leave behind when we you know, made our escapes? And I think that's what we found among these priests, that the not just the majority, but something like 98% of the cases of sexual abuse that we read about starting in 2001 and going forward, and we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of children who were sexually abused, were abused at the hands of men who would be clinically described as homosexual. Although they had no identity, they had no language to discuss it, and what they had instead was a theology that that condemned them and made their own self-knowledge almost impossible. And these priests believed that more than anything, because they were clinging to the priesthood. The priests who didn't believe it got out, and finally, you know, made peace with themselves. And so that crisis to me was really fascinating. The crisis where sexuality clashes with, in that case, theology. And I also was interested with the governor of New Jersey, who was the first sitting governor to come out. That, and he was totally in the closet, and he was right there in New Jersey, just moments away from New York City. And, you know, he could see New York City from his home. and yet he lived in the closet. You know, he was, and so I was fascinated about that. Like, what would be the factors that would twist, that you would use to twist your life up like that, mm-hmm. and why, and that clash was really fascinating to me. But all of this is this history that I've been kind of working with and trying to make sense of, is really a history of remarkable cultural evolution, or maybe even revolution, over the last 30 or 35 years, and the transformation. In the way that we handle sexual orientation has been remarkable, and probably the fastest or integration of a kind of a detested minority in like maybe even in world history, that it happened so quickly and thoroughly in that period of time, which is not to say that it's not over. We still have problems throughout the rest of certainly the United States, if not the rest of the world, and we're seeing awful things happen in parts of Africa and parts of Russia, for example. But what is? I think that's, I guess, what's been fascinating to me. What does that kind of change mean to the people who benefit from it, and to the people who don't benefit from it? And that, I think that's where I've dedicated my work.
I'm struck by by why you ascribe these. The priests as being homosexual. I have to read your work, that piece of it, to understand that, because I don't think of that. I think of that behavior just as I don't think of sexual assault of women as being, it is and it isn't sexual. You know what I mean? It's control, it's power, it's abuse, it's violence, it's many things. Mm. Is it sex?
Well, I'm not saying that it was an expression of sex.
You're saying
but
it's
an
identity,
outgrowth
though. You're saying
of their
it's an expression
sexual
of
orientation. Yeah. And I'll tell you why.
Even though so many of those priests, the pedophilia happened to little girls. Or is it the majority boys?
Well, it's majority not pedophilia. Now, pedophilia is clinically means a sexual attraction to pre-adolescent children, cherubic kind of children in which gender, and we know this from social science, the gender of the target is irrelevant. What was happening in the church is a systemic assault and cover-up of adolescent, post-adolescent boys. Young men, very, very, very young men.
And girls.
Not statistically. Yes, some girls included, some young women, some older women included. But statistically, the overwhelming data analysis of this population of victims is male post the age of 12 or 13, mostly 13, 14, 15, you know, right in that age group. And the what we know from social science is that those people who are classified as ephebophiles are attracted along the lines of their sexual orientation to the targets of their assaults. Now, the assault itself is not a sexual assault, but the question is, what can we know about that population of men? And Our Fathers is really an examination of the class of 1960 across the country, and that's the class of graduates from seminary that had the highest offense rate of 12% of the graduates of 1960 in the priesthood. We've never seen anything like that before in any other group of people, in any other profession. And so I wanted to find out who they were.
Okay, in microcosm, this conversation, the discomfort it evokes, the newness of it, the pain of it, that's what talking about sex is about. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I mean, that's why it's important to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And when you talk about people running away, I'm sorry, it just reminds me, I don't know if, well, California was a magnet for priests and nuns who decided it's time for a new verse. And it was my first year working in the feminist vibrator store, you know, and when these two women came in and very shyly asked me, and this doesn't look like what sex stores look like today. We had a museum of antiques on one wall, and then these things that looked like something left over from the blender department, you know, plugged into the wall. It wasn't a snazzy, slick atmosphere, but I was very, you know, game, and yes, I'll show you how everything works. And they were so adoring and affectionate, and I said, where did you meet each other? And they said, the convent, of course. And you're just reminding me, you know, that there was this kind of like, we're here, you know, now life begins, you know.
The Wizard of Oz.
The
thing,
Wizard of Oz, yeah. Everything's
and
in color.
And not everybody could do it.
Not everyone could do it. It's so...
You know, when you said earlier that you were thinking about when you were interested in where sex gets us into trouble, I immediately thought of Anthony Weiner. You know? I didn't go to the priests. I went to Anthony Weiner, and I was thinking, because I remember when he got into trouble, thinking, my goodness, he's doing that classic heterosexual man thing of, I didn't do it, oh, I didn't do it. And then you get caught in doing it, and then you have to like say, I'll never do it again. And then you get caught doing it again. And then it's, you know, instead of like having the space to say, yeah, you know, I mean, can you imagine if we lived in a truly sexually free society, he could have stood up and said, listen, that's my kink. You know what I mean? I text, I sext.
It was the weekend.
It harms nobody. My wife knows about it. It's all right. So, you know, go away, people. I mean, you can't even imagine a private figure saying that in their life, much less a public figure. You know, I felt that same way about Hillary and Bill. Right. You know, I thought, well, if they had an open understanding in their relationship, which I don't know that they did, you know, but I'm just, I don't know.
Right.
But I said, if they did, would they even be able to express it in public? No. He had to do that thing, like where, you know, it was like, Kate, my partner who's a comedian, used to joke that it was a very gay moment, both Weiner and Clinton, because they had to, like, it was all about the sex scandal. They had to backtrack. They were afraid of losing their jobs. It was like, you know, they were had to cover up themselves. And it would be so much more wonderful if they could be honest, if straight people could be honest about sex, too.
I'm reminded of an example, though, where it wasn't a straight example, but it was a political example, where Jerry Studs, you remember when he got caught having sex with a page?
Boys.
Right? And you would have thought that was going to ruin his career. And instead, he held a press conference and said, yeah. And he was old enough. Like, that was his only defense. And he was 18 years old. And that was defense enough at that time. And you know, going to that kind of cyclical thing in the early 80s when he did that, we were still willing to go, okay, sexuality is a regular part of a person's kind of life expression.
Well, this actually leads me to ask in terms of the selfie and the vibrator. These are images from the show, and there's one image we have of a vibrator from the 1900s. It looks like doesn't look like a Hitachi magic wand. Let me just put it that way. But I wonder if you all could comment on the new technologies, right? From selfies, I'm sure there are a lot of selfies in the audience if we were to check phones, online porn, sex sites, to dating apps like Grindr and Tinder. They're changing our relationship to our bodies, but also to the body politic. So I wonder how you see what technology is doing to intimacy, but also our relationship to the, more broadly, to the body politic.
I thought when the kind of digital universe came online that it was opening up sexuality again, mm-hmm. you know, certainly making it easier to have that kind of expression in public and also easier to get caught and harder to deny. And which are all good things, I think, somehow. But I also think that the social media has a kind of a false familiarity about it, and that in some way it hasn't given us back a kind of a conversation, although we might be engaged in a conversation now even more than before. And the Grindr thing, those app things that people are constantly studying and paying attention to and using and utilizing, you know, that it's not the same as, I don't know, community. And that idea that both Susie and Irvishi were talking about, that of discussion, of community input and working together on ideas, challenging one another on ideas. And actually, that's what it is, adding ideas to sex. Hmm. And maybe what these modalities that you described are doing is stripping ideas away from sex.
Well, I'm really mad there's not a lesbian Grindr. And, why can't you just pick up something and say, there's a woman down that hall, she'd like to meet me in 5 minutes? I mean, I was fascinated.
We have a name for it. It's called Find Her. But one of you who's a genius with programming should create that.
Yes. Oh, I see you have the concept and the brand name, yes. But not, okay.
But please credit Kate Clinton with the name, Find Her.
Her.
We'd like
Grind
a tiny percentage of the revenue.
But Grind Her is also good.
Grind Her.
I think Find Her is sort of the YA version. Yeah. but I often am thinking with all the technology, when you see like the same conservative attitudes, the way it's set up, you know, that women are searching for romance and you know,
yep.
true love with one person forever and ever, amen, you know, and then, you guys, we all know, you know, you want a quickie in the dark with Anthony Weiner and, you know, goodbye. You know, like, and so those kind of, the idea that you can have this amazing technology, but really Ozzy and Harriet ideas about sex is a big bore. So,
but there's also, yeah.
I mean, a lot of you may know when you think about vibrator technology that marvelous book by, help me with this, Rachel Maines. I always said Natalie Maines. She's the Dixie chick. No, Rachel Maines wrote The Technology of Orgasm because she was a scholar in women's crafts and she was studying knitting. And she went to a university that had like archived knitting magazines, and she said, why is there a vibrator ad in every knitting magazine? This advertising doesn't exist anywhere else, and that's what set her on her path. And then she discovers, you know, what the meaning of this electrical device was, along with the iron and, you know, the lamp. You know, just it changed everything. That was how her search began. I know this has already happened hundreds of times in our archive here, and it's going to continue, literally, pulling a thread and following it someplace else. Technology-wise, On Our Backs was able to publish after that first issue that cost an arm and a leg because we bought one of the first Macs, and it was the first media ever produced on an Apple, and I was always like, when is Steve Jobs going to call us and say thank you? And they said we could do it, but nobody did it, and it was people who were looking for a way to literally get the means of production. We were just desperate to break the cost and make it accessible. So there's a lot of little triumphs along the way, and of course, a lot of you have had those conversations that we wouldn't have Beta, then VHS, DVD, Blu-ray. All of that has happened because of the sex film industry. That it just, they set the standard. I mean, I can remember sitting in a room, we'll talk about this tomorrow when I do my movie show, of there's this literally a group of guys who play gin rummy every week, and they run the traditional porn film business, and discussing Beta versus VHS. And they knew they were going to be the ones to make the shoe drop. So, I have a love-hate relationship, but observing it and chronicling it is always going to be fascinating.
I have to confess, I don't use the new technology for sex.
You stopped at the vibrator.
I stopped at the vibrator. I guess. I think that the sexism and the racism of those spaces also just annoys me and disturbs me. And so, you still see those ads that we banned in gay community news in the classifieds, the sex classifieds, where people would say no fats, no femmes, no, right. No blacks. Those were advertisements, right. And sex ads, and I think they're offensive, and they still exist. And right. Of course, on the one hand, you could say if you're a libertarian, well, people are just trying to find their choice, and they're just being upfront about it. On the other hand, I think it's just, it's revolting. But that's me being judgmental. I also kind of resent the corporate control and the commodification of sex, and I resent it. I think I don't know how to get around it, in the sense that I use the technologies for a million other things, to communicate, to interface, to use social media, and enjoy it, but I find it, I'm still so old school that I don't, I don't trust the state, and I don't trust corporations, so I worry about all of that information. And Ed Snowden suggests that we should be worried because somebody is indeed compiling it, and for no good purpose or any purpose, but they're compiling it. That said, I think, you can't be a Luddite, and the way people are meeting each other, the way people are hooking up in cities, the way my friends who are single are hooking up is through dating websites, and they're not going to... But folks, my advice, join an organization, get involved in a movement. Don't just tweet, go volunteer. That's where you'll meet the hot chicks. Yeah. And
when you're being a sexual anthropologist, the crudeness of personal ads, I love reading older ads and seeing what people didn't want and what they did want. And some things are always the same. Yeah. Size queens have never gone out of style. but I remember when ads were first in women's community newspapers, and you would see things like no fluffs. And I remember wondering, what's a fluff? No femmes, no butches, soft butch only. And I'd be like, when does the butch start to go soft? But I remember thinking that at the time, being scared, being mesmerized that some people were going to just be this cut and dried about it. Of course, I thought it was rude, but I learned so much.
I understand.
And then later on, you look back on it and you see things come and go. You see how something becomes obsessions for personal appearance or style. I just love looking at it now, you know, as long as I don't have to be in the thick of it.
Well, why don't we watch a short clip from How to Survive a Plague, and it would be great for you all to just comment on all the loss, but also all the creativity in terms of when you're saying get organized. Yeah. And then we'll open it up. We're running out of time, but we'll open it up for discussion because we want to hear what the audience has to say.
Except, of course, we have Ann Northrup giving her soundbite technique.
You're trying to arouse to anger and action and hone it down to, yes, a 3-second bite, a 5-second bite, just a phrase that will have an impact, that will say something specific, and that will be understandable. So. Phrase worked out, and so you're all going to have to create your own. So this is empowerment.
In front of St. Patrick's Cathedral on Sunday, we're here reporting on a major AIDS activist and abortion rights activist demonstration, which will be taking place here all morning. Inside, Cardinal O'Connor is busy spreading his lies and rumors about the position of lesbians and gays. We're here to say we want to go to heaven too. Brimstone Network, and we'd like to ask you a little bit about this large vision that you visited upon us.
Well, we decided to rename the Cardinal. He's now Cardinal O'Condom. This is our message to him. The condoms are safe. It's no sin.
Believe that the protests will result in some change of environment, some change of attitudes, perhaps.
The church will be teaching that homosexual activity is sinful until the end of time. That won't change.
Well, I guess it kind of speaks for itself. I mean, one of the things that I found so refreshing about showing this film today, to bringing this history forward, is how people respond to Jesse Helms by laughing at him. Mm-hmm. because he seems so ridiculous. And that's a victory in itself, made possible by actions like this that sought to just set him apart as ridiculous. When in fact, at the time, as anybody who knows that history knows, he was the power in the Senate. Mm. He was the reason we didn't have a federal government response to the AIDS epidemic. He attached something called the Helms Amendment to all funding bills that prohibited spending any U.S. government money on anything which he deemed to be positive toward or encouraging.
The no promo homo.
Homosexuality,
amendment.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but that he seems so ridiculous now in history is, I think, one of the victories of ACT UP and AIDS activism.
Although Ted Cruz recently tried to bring him up as kind of an exemplary figure. This was about 6 months ago.
Right, yeah. It won't work. You know, there are a number of people who had a kind of a late-in-life conversion about their relationship to AIDS, and Jesse Helms was one of those. You know, he took a visit from Bono and then went, oh, yeah, I was kind of wrong. And so for like the last 15 minutes of his life, he tried to talk about AIDS in Africa, but he never made an apology to the gay community or to Americans whose suffering he encouraged and applauded. So I think ultimately we can say very clearly that he never made it to heaven.
I don't know. I think I'm a Hindu. We don't believe in heaven. So I can't say. But I was thinking about a couple of things in this clip. The creativity of AIDS activism and ACT UP in particular, ACT UP New York and ACT UP all over the world was amazing. And it's something that, it was inspiring to live through and be a part of. And it was really hellish. Because when we were doing actions in the 80s, and, you know, I was living in D.C., and I did a lot of, like, D.C.-based actions, and then I organized all these direct actions at the Republican Convention and the Democratic Conventions in 1988, both conventions, 92, 96, and the hostility you got, the negativity you got was intense. I remember once in Houston at the Republican convention, these young Americans for Freedom showed up in their suits with masks on, saying, with signs at one of our demonstrations saying, AIDS is the cure, you know? And they had these like hospital masks so they wouldn't get contaminated. Hmm. And that was like, you know, young people in that party. And I think it's really important. So to me, the second point that comes up from these clips is, yes, Helms, you know, we can see him as an isolated figure, but I think he was a spokesman for a view that still exists very much in this country, a view that homosexuality is immoral, sinful, wrong. And that's where the work of people who are working inside religious traditions to reframe that is so important. That's where there's a huge amount of work still to be done in you know, across the country. It isn't over, folks, despite the wins that we've had. It's far from over. And we have to really remember, look at history to remember the cyclical nature of repression and the ways that it recurs. So I'm just, you know, I just always have a suitcase packed on the back porch. Run away, it's and go underground.
I just love your movie, and I'll just go watch
movie.
It over and over again.
Wonderful.
And what you were talking about, just the look on their faces when they're all sitting in the truck, and you know they've just accomplished it, and that there is something very satisfying about exposing hypocrisy and and knowing you have the guts to do it, and you're not going to turn back. Relish those moments and inspiring people when they see this or when they see anything in our archives that makes them think, really? That happened when, then. I mean, when we look at some of the photographs of Radcliffe Hall in her top coat, yes, and we're like, she didn't give a damn.
That's right.
You know, yeah, that she just wrote The Well of Loneliness and dressed as she pleased and was, you know, transgender warrior before anybody had put any of those words together. So, yeah, there's, we have an inspiring collection.
Yeah, yeah. But and the movie is really, can we show another clip?
Sure. I just wanted to say, this is a line I picked up, Susie, from your memoir. I thought it's such a, just the wisdom in it. You say, perhaps because we are blunt about sex, we're not so afraid of death's taboo either. Mm. And I think there is a relationship when we take ownership of our sexuality, sexual lives, then that, our relationship to death also necessarily changes.
It's so true. I mean, and then when you had HIV and AIDS, capital letters, we were dealing with sex and death simultaneously at very young ages. All of a sudden, this wasn't even like a beautiful literary metaphor. Yeah. It was just right there. Mm-hmm. But that sentiment that we can do this and we have ownership of our bodies and the way we're going to die or the way we're going to live, from my women's movement side, that came so much out of midwifery and self-help groups and, you know, grab that cervix and let's take a look. And this is my uterus, my vagina, my clitoris, etc., all of that. And, you know, I'm going to decide how I want to give birth or how I want to administer my own abortion or all these things. You take the same notion and it informed hospice and death midwifery today. We went from that women's movement, our bodies, ourselves, to a kind of roll up your sleeves on gay activism to saying, I'm never, no matter what I face in life or what kind of death or illness that may come my way, this, I'm not just saying, I have a slip to see the hospital, they will determine how I do this. No one's ever going to say that again. And I think that's one of the biggest influences in healthcare today, is how you will die. And if you know how to talk about sex, you're just like at the head of the class.
Time's up, I guess.
You know, I know there's just a bunch of questions and comments, and I for one want to know what's the difference between a feminist vibrator and a non-feminist vibrator, but I'm going to ask that of Susie when we go over to the exhibit and the reception, which is right after this, and it's in our wonderful Division of Rare and Manuscript Collections. You can walk over to Stimson and go down the elevator. I'm conscious of not wanting to cut this off, but also honoring those who prepared a beautiful reception for us. I want to thank the staff of the library, Brenda Marston, Aisha Neely, and Catherine Reagan, and C.J. Lance, and Lynn Bertoya, and Gwen Glazier, and Joel Caculte. There's a whole bunch of them. David opened the door of the closet door of the card catalog by referencing homosexuality. I'm particularly pleased that the good staff at the Cornell Library introduced to the Library of Congress subject heading terms bears, gay subculture, butch, and feminine.